Today on Against the Grain, in the early days of the Central Intelligence Agency, Alan Dulles moved the CIA from Washington, D.C. to the suburbs, spawning a complex of government and private entities in the service of U.S. empire. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll talk with scholar Andrew Friedman about the significance of the National Security State's base in Northern Virginia. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Why is the capital of U.S. empire not a city, but the leafy green suburbs of Northern Virginia, home to the CIA, key private military contractors, and other central institutions of the national security state? That's a question explored in the book Covert Capital, Landscapes of Denial and the Making of U.S. Empire in the Suburbs of Northern Virginia, published by UC Press, which probes the imperial and intimate links between U.S. agents and their allies in southern Vietnam, Iran, Nicaragua, and elsewhere, including people like CIA agents Huntington and Alice Sheldon, best known as a science fiction writer by her male pseudonym James Tiptree. The author of Covert Capital is Andrew Friedman. He teaches history at Haverford College, and he joins me by telephone. Andrew Friedman, let's just start with some history. How did the CIA end up headquartered in the Northern Virginia suburbs?
Well, in the 50s, the CIA is basically spread across Washington, D.C. in a variety of buildings, headquartered on E Street in these ruined, ramshackle, leaking, stinking tempos on the Capitol Mall, and in a variety of other buildings around the district. And they start looking for a new headquarters around 1954, 1955. And Northern Virginia becomes the site that they go to, I would say, for a variety of reasons. I mean, the site of Langley is federally owned land, which put it ahead of some other sites. But as I argue in the book, one reason CIA Director Alan Dulles was particularly drawn to this landscape is that he was very familiar with it because of the sort of social circle that had defined the Northern Virginia suburbs and summer homes outside the district, really going back to the Coolidge administration, but in particular with the 1950 building of his sister Eleanor's modernist house, pretty much right around the corner, so to speak, from the Langley headquarters, where him and John Foster Dulles and a variety of other CIA and other elites had gone basically throughout the 50s and 60s to a variety of elite pool parties and other sorts of social affairs that kind of lubricated the workings of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. empire in the early period. So when the CIA moves there, it basically elaborates that prehistory into a new set of suburban developments, which I argue incubate and continue to foment U.S. empire in the later period.
And before we get into more detail about exactly what that looked like, perhaps you could remind our listeners about the origins of the CIA and what was going on within the institution at the time that it made this shift.
Well, so the CIA comes into being with the National Security Act, which also gives us the Air Force in 1947. And so these are the early what CIA insiders sometimes think of as the heady days of the CIA, when with almost unlimited budgets and the sort of blessing of early American presidents, the CIA is going out into the world to invent the sort of civilian and covert action wing of U.S. foreign policy. I argue in my book that the CIA's rise is coincident with the era of global decolonization. So in my book, I actually kind of eschew the Cold War as the most meaningful frame to think about this period and look at global decolonization as essentially what the CIA, particularly under the Alan Dulles tenure, is working to subvert and manage and adjudicate in various ways on behalf of the U.S. state.
In essence, you're saying that when we look at this period and we look at the emergence of the CIA after its founding by Congress in 1947, that you're saying that the framework of seeing it as just simply being formed to be a countervailing force to the efforts of the Soviet Union is not the most useful way of understanding it. And so how should we?
Well, I think that what's interesting to me about the CIA in particular is the ways that it promises two kinds of efficiency to the U.S. government. The first kind of efficiency is analysis and the orderly processing of information, and in that sense, the CIA is in line with the sort of organization man era of the 1950s and the other sorts of ways that business and efficiency was a rubric for that entire period. But then the CIA also, to my lights, flips that same rhetoric of efficiency in its promises as part of this sort of Eisenhower New Look vision of U.S. foreign policy, that the CIA will sort of efficiently manage global affairs and war by obviating the necessity for formal wars, that with a kind of results-oriented dispatch, the CIA will be able to manage global affairs for presidents and other American officials without the sort of costly and damaging in its original promise engagements of World War II and World War I. But other people sort of see the rise of the CIA as almost a counter to the United Nations, that at the very moment of the United Nations founding, the CIA comes in as a way for the U.S. to manage its own affairs and sort of reimagine the globe in this new, what I would think of as a newly rising era of U.S. imperialism that the CIA essentially comes to manage. The other thing about the CIA that I think is important is that the CIA's terrain of work is the personal. It's about personal relationships and working through the social sphere, which is something key to all early CIA actions and agendas. But at the same time, I think the results we see from these promises of efficiency in the early period are not only incredibly inefficient, but also extremely violent and brutal for years after that. So I think we always need to take the rhetoric of what the CIA is supposed to be doing with a grain of salt as we look at what it actually is doing around the world.
Sure. So what was the relationship between the CIA and the White House in these early years when, as you say, under Alan Dulles, the CIA shifted its headquarters to the suburbs of Northern Virginia?
Well, that's actually something I look a lot at in the book. I'm actually, you know, not only saying that the CIA is the single entity that manages U.S. imperialism around the world. I think actually what's interesting about looking at the suburbs and the social sphere and this landscape where a lot of federal officials of all types are and a lot of officials who are working through various international engagements for the U.S., is that the CIA is one arm of a U.S. imperial policy that stretches across various entities, but which I argue comes to sediment in what I call the covert capital, Northern Virginia's sort of secret capital of U.S. imperialism, as an answer vis-a-vis Washington's overt symbolic capital of U.S. democracy and whatever else is supposed to be symbolized by Washington. But, I mean, a lot of CIA historians and a lot of other historians would agree that the CIA rises to a new kind of autonomy and prominence because of the close relationship and almost the triumvirate of relations between Eisenhower, Alan Dulles, and John Foster Dulles. And I mean, I think what's interesting is that all of those people had had deep experiences in Northern Virginia leading into the 50s. I mean, Eisenhower had spent time at his brother Milton's house in Falls Church when Milton was designing the National Program for Japanese Internment. And Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles had circulated through that terrain for years as part of a sort of elite family of federal officials and people who really back till the 20s had been involved with managing the relationships between the United States and the world.
So what is the significance then of, as you put it, the headquarters of U.S. empire not being based in a city but being based in a suburb?
I think it's really crucial. I mean, there are different ways that I think that works in Northern Virginia. I mean, one, the Northern Virginia landscape is this landscape with its own incredibly complex racist and racial regimes stretching back to Jim Crow and the Confederacy. In another way, the Northern Virginia landscape is actually much emptier, particularly Upper Fairfax County, than a lot of other suburbs around Washington, which really gives the CIA and the early CIA the opportunity to sort of design a landscape from scratch, and both a set of cultural mores and architectural spaces. At times, I almost think it's useful to look at the ways that they saw development and building worlds anew as so crucial to their project because of their own kind of nation and community building they're always doing in the Northern Virginia suburbs. There's also this key break with the sort of fixed relationships and sort of almost balance of powers that exist through D.C.'s urbanism with the sort of isolated and covert relationships that can arise around the Langley headquarters once that gets built. I think just the very fact of there being a social sphere that can be used to condense resources, plan actions, manage debts and exclusions, and create a new kind of sense of being, selfhood, cultural values, and always be reiterated through feelings of social amity, intimacy, and closeness among CIA elites and other U.S. imperial figures circulating through Northern Virginia, I think, make something new possible after 1950, and particularly after the headquarters opens in 1961, than was possible within some of the fixed relationships of D.C.'s own urbanism.
And so how did it come to pass that other institutions of the national security state also located themselves in the suburbs of Northern Virginia?
Well, the Pentagon moves out there earlier. The Pentagon is finding during the booming war economies of World War II that its new headquarters, which eventually goes to the State Department in the district, is immediately too small for it. And they start planning space for the Pentagon out in Northern Virginia, basically opens in 1943. And as I argue in the book, it's the Pentagon and the CIA, these two key institutions that are sort of bracketing and anchoring this covert capital. And then on the other end, once Dulles Airport opens in 1962, it becomes, I argue, its own kind of national security institution as the site when so many agents and spies are flying out to the world and flying back after their engagements with the world. These brackets for this landscape in Northern Virginia, about 25 miles wide, become this sort of circulatory system for U.S. imperial endeavor. I mean, there's a variety of other institutions that arise there. Something that's actually key in the book for me is that you actually learn something different about the functioning of U.S. imperialism by not purely looking at the national security state or institutions, but in sometimes very informal social networks and spaces that take on key imperial roles but are not necessarily the ones we're immediately drawn to when we think of the materialization or the material qualities of the national security state. So I look at a lot of things like domestic houses or shopping malls or office buildings, things that aren't necessarily seen as key to these relationships, but to me are really central.
So perhaps, Andrew, you could describe this built landscape, these suburbs for us, for people who may not be familiar with this area outside of Washington, D.C. What does it look like?
Well, I think for many people, if you drove through it, it would look like any other quote-unquote nice, normal, desirable, wealthy suburb, assuming that we think all those adjectives are actually nice and normal and desirable, which I think is part of the argument that these suburbs make about themselves. I think what was interesting to me about the book was thinking about the ways the normal, nice, and desirable American space is not other to American empire, but actually defined by it. Part of the ways that I was trying to look at U.S. imperialism and its management as a matter of routine, one that's integrated into the fabric of American life rather than other to it or just a kind of left-wing metaphor for global superpower status or something, I was really interested in thinking about American empire's functionality. So when you go to Northern Virginia, you see malls and edge cities and office parks and suburban subdivisions, some of them with traditional neo-colonial houses. I mean, one slight difference with a lot of Northern Virginia, and particularly parts of the early sections of it built in the 60s, is that there's a somewhat prominent presence of modernist architecture there. There was a particular way that the sort of self-evident newness and cutting-edgeness of modern architecture and the way that it gave practitioners the feeling that boundaries were dissolving, or in some senses with glass-walled houses almost being a kind of brazen, kind of cocky argument about security. Those are also parts of the built environment in Northern Virginia. So I think in some sense it looks like a lot of other suburbs, but I think what's interesting to me then is thinking about how the normative suburban life or the normal suburban life becomes a kind of alibi or what I call a landscape of denial, where through moving through this built landscape, turning corners, going out to eat, shopping, going back to your house, going to work, you're actually moving through what I would call this landscape of denial, where the place itself is both an argument and a function of U.S. imperialism, a sort of structure to help practitioners evade the ethical implications of imperial action, and sort of make imperial and violent work tolerable and socially reproducible in a sense. In a more geographic way, these suburbs are right over the Potomac, basically from Washington, pretty much to the southwest of the D.C. line, and then stretching through Fairfax County, about 8 miles wide on either side, and then about 25 miles out to Dulles Airport, although certainly since then, geopolitical uses for this space have stretched far beyond that into the Virginia countryside.
Well, obviously, they have changed over time, but what can you say about the lives of CIA personnel in this environment? Obviously, supposed to be shrouded in secrecy, but since you're saying that the personal and social sphere is so actually crucial in sustaining U.S. imperialism, what do we know about the lives of people who are members of this national security state?
Well, I mean, I think their lives can be complicated. And, you know, when we say members of the national security state or members of U.S. imperialism, something that I'm quite interested in is thinking about the ways empire doesn't always work as purely a violence enacted by a white American imperialist and a victim of color around the world, but that a lot of the ways that U.S. imperialism worked was by founding imperial communities of different sorts. But I always maintain that these imperial communities are themselves defined in incredibly vexed, violent ways, where intimacies themselves can sometimes be continuations of imperial violence by other means. I think there's also an interesting dimension when looking at social life in Northern Virginia, where the brutality and hierarchy and other sorts of aspects of U.S. imperialism abroad or violent U.S. endeavors around the world can inflect back in complicated ways into CIA and other U.S. imperial families, too. I think one of the most interesting tropes that defines writing about the CIA is this idea of the CIA wife. And the CIA wife is a figure whose labor is often not recognized as being a key aspect of continuing U.S. imperial policies. But the CIA wife is crucial. These women for whom patriotic loyalty is wrapped into national responsibility and domestic labor, who are doing functional work around houses, dividing zones of houses so truce can be spoken or hidden, managing odd schedules and hours, breaking camp essentially and rebuilding and redesigning domestic spheres abroad and then quickly redesigning them back at home, and managing some of the emotional fallout from U.S. imperial labor. At the same time, for some U.S. imperial actors, they themselves are constantly managing friendships that last 10, 20, 30 years and move abroad, move to Saigon, move elsewhere in the world, move home to Northern Virginia, and take place at home and abroad in sometimes quite similar colonial houses, living rooms, places that are always repatriating art and objects from service abroad to service at home, and often socializing with quite mixed and racially diverse groups of figures who they had formed intimacies with at home and abroad. But again, I think the ways that you can come back into Northern Virginia and its suburbs as a racialized person who had been key to U.S. operations abroad can be quite vexed by the ways that race appears in Northern Virginia as a way to manage imperial debts and exclusions and the sort of dimensions of empire that become complicated when people actually testify to and claim the sort of reparation of migration that was promised to them abroad and come back to these suburbs that are still often defined by a normative whiteness, even when they're also seen as incredibly diverse, as the Northern Virginia suburbs are well known for being.
Sure, and I will ask you about some of that complexity in a moment, but I wonder if you could tell us about the story of Huntington and Alice Sheldon, which you explore in the book.
Yeah, they're quite an interesting duo. And I mean, in asking about the social lives of early CIA families, I think they're an interesting one. I mean, coming from quite educated, elite backgrounds, Yale educated, often having quite quirky lives inside and outside the agency. I think when they moved to Northern Virginia and build this modernist house, essentially right around the time that the CIA headquarters is announced, they're right in the mix with these people who imagine themselves going to Northern Virginia not as a retreat from a public democratic city, but actually as a continuation of the engaged sort of work and thrumming social milieus these often liberal folks thought of themselves as being engaged with. Huntington Sheldon becomes one of the key analysts at the agency, defining these intelligence reports that go directly to Kennedy and is involved throughout a lot of the U.S.-Cuba crises and relationships throughout the early 60s. And Alice Sheldon herself is a CIA agent working in photo interpretation and other kinds of analysis and sort of covert clandestine, at times, analysis directed against Africa. And the reason that she is focused on Africa is she herself, as a child, had gone on these safaris in Africa with her mother, who is a very famous writer, adventurer. So similarly, many CIA agents, often people are coming in with these experiences and complicated engagements with the world in earlier periods. I mean, famously, people would say that the CIA officers post-war, who were the children of oil executives, would be assigned to the Middle East, and the children of missionaries would be assigned to the Far East. And I think Alice Sheldon is one of those figures where her safari background assigns her to work on Africa. But the difference, and I don't know, I mean, this is in a sense an intensification of the roles that CIA wives and CIA families are always engaged with, but through the 60s and into the 70s, as Huntington Sheldon is getting busier at work, I mean, famously, when the Bay of Pigs, and particularly when the Cuban Missile Crisis is going on, he's bringing a lot of Strasbeck into their house, hiding gold coins in the basement, secreting gasoline here and there, waiting for whatever might be the post-Cuban Missile Crisis, domestic crisis. Alice Sheldon is working through her own cover story of being a wife at home when actually she had a really complicated background as herself, not only a CIA agent, but an intellectual in all kinds of ways, getting a PhD in psychology at GW and always being an extremely eloquent interlocutor with a variety of people. So Alice Sheldon takes on this own double identity, essentially becoming the writer James Tiptree, one of the most famous science fiction writers still today. I mean, more and more people are working on Tiptree's work now. And I argue in the book that a lot of the stories that Tiptree writes are actually informed by the sort of fantasies of apocalypse and crisis and sort of drawn out nightmares that she's experiencing through this sort of landscape of denial that is the early suburbs around the Langley headquarters. The Sheldon House is essentially right across the street from the Langley headquarters. I mean, it couldn't be closer. It's almost like a bodega next to a city apartment or something like that. That's how close they are. And they have one of these early modernist houses, you know, glass windows built by a really famous DC firm, and almost gardens growing up through the house. So at the same time that the house is almost a celebration of their own work at the kind of cutting edge of civilization and abundance and daring, there's this way that they end up having a life pressured by and cut by the machinations of U.S. imperialism and CIA work, until finally, later in life, she, according to her biographer and other writers, finally shoots her husband and shoots herself in their home in McLean sometime in the 80s. And then the house gets knocked down and swept into the next phase of Northern Virginia covert development.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with historian Andrew Friedman about his book, Covert Capital, Landscapes of Denial and the Making of U.S. Empire in the Suburbs of Northern Virginia. That's published by UC Press. He teaches history at Haverford College. One of the episodes of the CIA's history and the history of the U.S. national security state that you explore in Covert Capital is that of those who are involved in U.S. counterinsurgency efforts in southern Vietnam. Tell us about how the connections were made between those involved in such efforts in Vietnam and their return, or their migration rather, to Northern Virginia, making the area, I believe, the third largest population of Vietnamese in America.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a long-held set of relationships. I mean, one thing that I think is really important to think about when imagining the intertwined development of U.S. counterinsurgency in Vietnam and the development of the Northern Virginia suburbs is that the Northern Virginia suburbs themselves are being developed in this period. I think there's a way sometimes we can think of suburbs as being these fixed entities that are already fully formed and fully fleshed out. But, you know, these suburbs have hardly anything in them by contemporary standards of what a densely sprawling, wealthy suburb would look like. So I actually look a lot at how new kinds of landscapes are taking form together, ones that have implicit violences and exclusions, both in Vietnam and in Northern Virginia. I mean, I start by looking at the earliest Economic Cooperation Administration program officers who are going to Vietnam in 1950, long before people even imagine U.S. counterinsurgency or even the Vietnam War starting, and are already imagining how new kinds of communities will produce new sorts of subjectivity and conscripts for American power, which is exactly the same thing they're doing in Northern Virginia at the same time.
Can you explain what you mean by new subjectivities?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's complicated, but I think that there's a way that people are imagining in this period that changes in the land can make people different, and they can produce free subjects, and they can produce subjects focused on individuality and family life, and they can produce people who are used to moving and navigating along roads and a fabric of space in a particular kind of way. They're imagining a sort of nurturing, modern, participatory life. or healthy American spaces that are defined in particular ways, I would say also already always defined by exclusion in some sense. But there are these key cognates and relationships between the ways people are imagining space in Vietnam and the ways they're imagining space in Northern Virginia, this sort of over-focus on the home as a site of politics and loyalty, and in a sense, a kind of politics of speculation, as I call it in the book, where they're thinking about time, change, and development and these bright horizons of future spaces that will be designed differently than the ones that are there when they start. What these counterinsurgency and other policies are always intervening in Vietnam is the history of Vietnam's own decolonization and declaration of independence and the sort of breaking of Vietnamese nationalism that's happening in these transitions from the French to the Americans in the 50s. And in both places, really, they're all shaping farmland for geopolitical ends. After the earliest figures from Northern Virginia go to Vietnam and then come home to Northern Virginia and build developments they named after Saigon, which now just stand in the Northern Virginia suburbs as sort of odd names that fold into a variety of suburban development names and sort of lose their history in a way. Then some of the most famous developers of counterinsurgency in U.S. history go to Saigon, Edward Lansdale and the Saigon Military Mission, and essentially his stable crew of friends and figures and colleagues who returned to Vietnam with him again and again, basically from 54 to 1968. At the same time, they're constantly going back to Northern Virginia and moving into its first subdivisions and building some of its first self-designed houses. And you actually notice, I mean, a thing I spend a lot of time doing is comparing building permits in Northern Virginia building and county building archives, which are like the one place that covert agents have to meet the overt state, to declassified documents and other histories that mark and trace the movements that a lot of these figures are doing back and forth. And I almost see that these movements cast a different light on how we imagine U.S. imperial space. I mean, in European contexts and for the few people who try to imagine U.S. imperial spatial relationships, usually people are thinking about the metropole and the colony. That's like the famous relational way of imagining imperial space. Colonials travel to the metropole, metropolitans travel to the colonies. But I think the thing that's interesting to me about the Northern Virginia suburbs is the way that these places really become co-constituted. They are almost a shared landscape, in my view, that's being formed at the same time by the same people often. And so by the time a lot of Vietnamese allies and intimates and friends and wives of these figures from Northern Virginia who've been moving back and forth for so long return to the Northern Virginia suburbs, I would argue that they know more about America than many of their new neighbors do, than many Americans do, and that for all intents and purposes, they're in American spheres before they enter not only the continental United States, but the Northern Virginia suburbs writ large, which I think is an important distinction. I mean, and these relationships and U.S. imperialism doesn't cloud the fact that Vietnam has its own set of complex histories that completely transcend these relationships. But as far as U.S. imperialism goes, there is a U.S. imperial landscape that transcends contiguous space in a sense and almost knits non-contiguous landscapes together as taking form alongside one another.
So is that what you mean by the term that you used, imperial communities, that essentially there are people being brought together? So in this case, those agents of the CIA based in Northern Virginia, those people who were allies of the CIA in South Vietnam, and that they actually form a kind of a web or network that needs to be taken seriously when thinking about how U.S. empire operates. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think they also need to be taken seriously in the sense of how imperial repatriation defines and affects the U.S. polity and ideas about U.S. racial formations domestically. I think there are sort of two scales that I think of when considering some of the ethics of these relationships. I mean, there are these imperial communities and intimacies. And, I mean, one thing I think a lot about in the book is how to think about the responsibilities and debts and testimonies of these relationships. How did it happen that people who were once cast as so essential to America become so ignored and mistreated or made to have a difficult time under U.S. immigration law or just everyday life in these suburbs that are defined by presumptive or supposedly normative whiteness? But then, of course, there's the second level of how to imagine the ethics of imperial communities, which is that U.S. imperialism is often violating people in their everyday lives and making it so they have no futures or deeply altered futures defined by a kind of ruin caused by U.S. intervention. So I think it's a challenge to think complexly and subtly about how to articulate intimacy and community, but also articulate and acknowledge violence and assault.
Well, one example that you explore in depth that illustrates some of the points that you're making right now about these interlinkages is that of Iran-Contra. Now, this, of course, jumps us to 1987. You had been talking in many ways about the earlier period, or maybe it's the golden age of the CIA for its boosters. Can you remind us first about what the Iran-Contra scandal was all about?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny you ask about explaining what Iran-Contra was. I think many people still have trouble doing that, and I think it takes some work figuring out exactly what was going on there. And I think, even the name Iran-Contra is almost itself designed as a kind of covert rune that needs to be deciphered or not, which I think is an interesting way that a scandal like Iran-Contra functions. I mean, it sort of almost dares you to be interested in figuring it out. And the sort of boredom inherent in a sort of abstruse name like that, I think, is one way that the covert operates. I think, on the other hand, I was sort of interested in thinking about how we might think about scandals as what Frederick Jameson and Kevin Lynch call cognitive maps, that they're almost instructions for reading the world. And so I sort of tried to take up the map of Iran-Contra as that, basically, as a way to sort of try to read a set of imperial relationships in the 70s and 80s that are vectored through Northern Virginia, but actually linking Iran and Central America and the suburbs of Northern Virginia, three places that in very few area studies or regionally focused histories of U.S. foreign policy would ever be seen to be linked, but in Iran-Contra, they do become linked. So anyway, Iran-Contra as a scandal is essentially a group of National Security Council and private and other sorts of complexly situated U.S. imperial agents between the CIA and the sort of shadowier wings of the Pentagon and other parts of the Northern Virginia contracting and private business landscape rig up this whole system to essentially sell arms to Iran's Islamic Republic, supposedly the sworn enemy of the people who are doing the selling and in violation of a federal order to the effect that shouldn't be done, and using the proceeds of those sales to route money to the Contras, who are the CIA reformed and recruited guerrillas, basically, or insurgents who are trying to destabilize the new Sandinista government of Nicaragua. So that's essentially what Iran-Contra is. I mean, I read it in the book as a sign of the fact that covert action and space had a new way of being managed in Northern Virginia at the dawn of the Reagan administration. I mean, and on the one hand, contracting, corporatization, privatization, are the new order of the day, almost radical forms of the quote-unquote compartmentation. Compartmentation is this word that the CIA had always used to imagine the division and breaking up of the accountability and sort of knowledge chains of any of its covert actions. Now those come to be articulated in terms of contracting, corporatization, and privatization. I mean, one caveat that I feel like is important here, though, is that these supposedly private contracting, corporatized networks were always completely defined by U.S. government figures, U.S. government money. So in a sense, I think it's important not to see them as actually private, but as a way of articulating a kind of new national imperial agency and publicness in this particular way.
So you're talking about work being outsourced to private companies that obviously have close ties to or still constitute the national security state. But that's what you're talking about, subcontracting
of the work.
Yeah, I mean,
sometimes not even companies that didn't even exist. I mean, sometimes they're just shell companies formed by sort of Pentagon shadow wings that operate or name themselves as companies but aren't actually even companies. But yeah, essentially the ways that contracting itself is not private. It's a figure for a particular way of arranging public money and public endeavor.
Sure, and people, of course, like Edward Snowden, later on being a contract employee.
Yeah, and I mean, contract employees are through the roof now. I mean, as a lot of critical scholars have written, but they often are coming out of the agencies that they then are coming back to contract to, and that's certainly the case with some of the figures who are central to Iran-Contra in this later period. The other thing I think is interesting about this sort of newness of this Iran-Contra era in Northern Virginia is the way that it always comes along with these new fantasies of wholeness or masculinity or country, place, community, family, tradition, history, and this way that they're actually inventing something radically new and dangerous, but also something very familiar, and at the same time, reaffirming all these sorts of fantasies of wholeness is not only an interesting irony or paradox, but I think another part of the way that this agenda gets articulated at this time.
Can you just say a bit more about that? What do you mean by wholeness?
Well, I mean, I think it's just interesting how a lot of the figures who are really disrupting everyday life, community, village, farm, territory in Central America are coming home to houses defined by what they imagine as ultra-traditional or normative heterosexual gender arrangements and households or small-town lives and farm communities. And I just think that there's something important to recover about the fact that what makes some of these engagements possible is new secret offices in gleaming, opaque-windowed corporate buildings in edge cities by malls, or new extremely complicated chains of relationship between companies and semi-incorporated companies and different agencies and contracts and routes. But then their self-presentation, and particularly Oliver North and some of the other folks who are presenting themselves during the various congressional hearings and other sorts of public fallout from the scandal, are always reifying and reaffirming their sense of traditionalness or their sense of uninterrupted masculinity or historical presence, which belies at times the very modern and very 80s in a way, almost campy sort of Wall Street era politics and built spaces that they spend most of their time inhabiting.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Andrew Friedman about his book, Covert Capital, Landscapes of Denial and the Making of U.S. Empire in the Suburbs of Northern Virginia. So how did the Iran-Contra scandal, how can we see the actual physical links that were made between Iran, Nicaragua, and Northern Virginia in the wake of this scandal? What's the ways that, in terms of people's intimate lives, one can see that manifested?
Well, I mean, I think one way that we see those relationships is the way the built environment in Northern Virginia, particularly around what scholars call edge cities, these sort of dense office park type spaces around malls and highway interchanges or other transit nodes that are really developing since the 60s, but come into this new kind of pronounced identity in the landscape in the 1980s. I mean, you really see the same contracting dollars and sort of renewal of U.S. imperial effort that's defining the Reagan years convulsing through these new spectacular skyscrapers almost that are coming to Tyson's Corner and other parts of the Northern Virginia landscape. And, you know, the fact that some of those office buildings themselves had the capacity to become SCIFs, as they're known in the industry, which are secure compartmentalized information facilities. That's one translation of that jargon, but essentially rooms at, or rows of rooms that can almost be locked out from buildings like safes. Sometimes the opaque windows you see on the outside don't actually have real windows behind them. They're just blind walls. And there's something about some of these cubicled office buildings that seems so normal when you're just driving past highway interchanges in any suburb around the country, but particularly in Northern Virginia, that made new kinds of radical compartmentation possible, I argue. The other way that you see it, and I mean, this is something important to me throughout the book, I followed into my writing about Iran-Contra, is the ways that Iran-Contra isn't just standing in for this kind of metaphor or description of this abstruse set of interchanges between dollars and weapons and violence that define U.S. covert action and policy in Iran and Central America, but they're also a trace and a figure for all these human movements and human relationships that are also coming into Northern Virginia at this time. I mean, whether it be the Central American immigrants who are cleaning, sprucing, and shining the landscape of the very people who planned and executed the destruction of their home territory, or the many Iranian migrants, including members of the Pahlavi and Shahzon family who are arriving in Northern Virginia at this time, and developing some of its key postmodern spaces in the same zones where the office buildings are arising, thinking about the ways that people are always back and forth moving spaces, moving lives, moving themselves based on friendships, acrimony, or at times almost a kind of testimony to relationships that are being disavowed by the United States, but through a movement to Northern Virginia, to my lights, speak back against the erasure of the long-held, long-duration chains and ties that have bonded all these places together. I mean, one other thing that I think is important to look at when thinking about these relationships is the way that Central Americans and Iranians are coming into Northern Virginia at the same time and facing both a sort of domestic regime of how people imagine race and races and racism, but then also carrying the freight of U.S. racializations and U.S. racisms directed against different peoples and creating different ideas of race abroad. And so I think it's important, even when looking at these ties and these long-held relationships that are producing imperial migrations, to also think about how the comparative racialization that U.S. empire does both abroad and at home serves a particular kind of purpose or a particular kind of use in processing the testimonies and deaths of empire and the rights and claims to safety that different people have when they arrive in the suburban home front.
Well, let me ask you, and let me end by asking you about how this area, the suburban center of the national security state, how has it been changed by the so-called war on terror?
I mean, well, that's actually what I think is interesting. In some sense, how little it has changed, even as it has changed. I mean, I think there's a way that, you know, I go to landscape and a place like Northern Virginia as a kind of archive and as bearing a kind of knowledge about U.S. imperialism or the security state that actually is quite different than the ways these epics in the U.S. Engagement and often assault on the Third World or the Global South is organized in these different periods of U.S. history. So, you know, a lot of the same figures and the same spaces that were key to the so-called Cold War in U.S. Imperial Northern Virginia become key to the so-called War on Terror in the same suburbs. So I think I would almost look at that more as a sense of continuation, although certainly the national intelligence reorganizations of the Bush years have spun out all kinds of new covert headquarters in the same zones around the CIA and Langley, which in some sense reads back and celebrates Allen Dulles' original vision for moving the CIA to Langley in the first place, which was that by having a permanent place and a permanent home with a protected perimeter of trees, the CIA would be institutionalized in American government and could not be uprooted in the same way as it could be when it was in various flimsy temporary buildings on the Capitol Mall. So I think in the same way that just as decolonization is moving apace in 1947 with the independence of India following various other independences of the late World War II period, and just at the time that all these countries are becoming independent, Truman and the U.S. government say, hey, wait, now there's this thing called the Cold War, so you guys can't be independent yet because we have this Cold War, and if you were independent, because you that would just create a vacuum for one of the superpowers to take you over, there's no independence for you. I think there's a way to see the transition between the end of the Cold War and the supposed peace dividend we were all waiting for to the new War on Terror period as another kind of those transitions where the permanent sort of war state and covert action state perpetuates itself in a particular kind of way because of the material and social capital condensed in a particular headquarters and home front like Northern Virginia.
We'll have to leave it right there. Andrew Friedman, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
I've been speaking with the author of Covert Capital, Landscapes of Denial and the Making of U.S. Empire in the Suburbs of Northern Virginia. That's published by University of California Press. Andrew Friedman is Assistant Professor of History at Haverford College. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.F. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.